Hi, I'm Flo Hale, and this is Arts Alive, etc. And I'm so happy today we're coming upon the holiday season, but I'm not sure whether these shows are going to be aired during the holiday season. But I'm very happy to have a wonderfully talented actress and singer, Allison Davey, reading a wonderful, wonderful Christmas story. And so I'm just going to turn it over to Allison and say, Allison, please, the mic is yours.
The Littlest Angel. Once upon a time, oh, many, many years ago as time is calculated by men, but which was only yesterday in the celestial calendar of heaven, there was, in paradise, a most miserable, thoroughly unhappy, and utterly dejected cherub who was known throughout heaven as the Littlest Angel. He was exactly 4 years old, 6 months, 5 days, 7 hours, and 42 minutes of age when he presented himself to the venerable gatekeeper and waited for admittance to the glorious kingdom of God. Standing defiantly with his short brown legs wide apart, the littlest angel tried to pretend that he wasn't at all impressed by such unearthly splendor and that he wasn't at all afraid. But his lower lip trembled, and a tear disgraced him by making a new furrow down his already tear-streaked face, coming to a precipitous halt at the very tip end of his small, freckled nose. From that moment on, the heavenly peace was never quite the same. But that wasn't all. While the kindly gatekeeper was entering the name in his great book, the littlest angel, having left home as usual without a handkerchief, endeavored to hide the telltale evidence by snuffing, a most unangelic sound, which so unnerved the good gatekeeper that he did something he had never done before in all eternity. He blotted the page. From that moment on, the heavenly peace was never quite the same. And the littlest angel soon became the despair of all the heavenly host. His shrill, ear-splitting whistle resounded all hours through the golden streets. It startled the patriarch, prophets, and disturbed their meditations. Yes, and on top of that, he inevitably and vociferously sang off-key at the singing practice of the heavenly choir, spoiling its ethereal effect. And being so small that it seemed to take him just twice as long as anyone else to get to nightly prayers, the littlest angel always arrived late and always knocked everyone's wings askew as he darted into his place. Although these flaws in behavior might have been overlooked, the general appearance of the littlest angel was even more disreputable than his deportment. It was first whispered among the seraphim and cherubim, and then it was said aloud among the angels and archangels that he didn't even look like an angel. And they were all quite correct. He didn't. His halo was permanently tarnished where he held onto it with one hot little chubby hand when he ran, and he was always running. Furthermore, even when he stood very still, it never behaved like a halo should. It was always slipping down over his right eye, or over his left eye, or else, just for pure meanness, it slipped off the back of his head and rolled away down some golden street just so he'd have to chase after it. Yes, and it must be here recorded that his wings were neither useful nor ornamental. All paradise held its breath when the littlest angel perched himself like an unhappy, fledgling sparrow on the very edge of a gilded cloud and prepared to take off. He would teeter this way and that way, but after much coaxing and a few false starts, he would shut both of his eyes, hold his freckled nose, count up to 303, and hurl himself slowly into space. However, owing to the regrettable fact that he always forgot to move his wings, the littlest angel always fell head over halo. It was also reported, and never denied, that whenever he was nervous, which was most of the time, he bit his wingtips. Now, anyone can easily understand why the littlest angel would, sooner or later, have to be disciplined. And so, on an eternal day of an eternal month in the year eternal, he was directed to present his small self before an angel of the peace. The littlest angel combed his hair, dusted his wings, and scrambled into an almost clean robe, and then with a heavy heart trudged his way to the place of judgment. He tried to postpone the dreaded ordeal by loitering along the street of the guardian angels, pausing a few timeless moments to minutely pursue a long list of new arrivals, although all heaven knew he couldn't read a word. And he idled more than several immortal moments to carefully examine a lovely display of harps, although everyone in Celestial City knew he couldn't tell a crotchet from a semiquaver. But at length, and at last, he slowly approached a doorway which was surmounted by a pair of golden scales, signifying that heavenly justice was dispensed within. To the littlest angel's great surprise, he heard a merry voice singing. The littlest angel removed his halo and breathed upon it heavily, then polished it upon his robe, a procedure which added nothing to that garment's already untidy appearance, and then tiptoed in. The singer, who was known as the Understanding Angel, looked down at the small culprit, and the littlest angel instantly tried to make himself invisible by the ingenious process of withdrawing his head into the collar of his robe, very much like a snapping turtle. At that, the singer laughed a jolly, heartwarming sound and said, "Oh, so you're the one who's been making heaven so unheavenly. Come here, cherub, and tell me all about it." The littlest angel ventured a furtive look from beneath his robe, first one eye and then the other eye. Suddenly, almost before he knew it, he was perched on the lap of the understanding angel and was explaining how very difficult it was for a boy who suddenly finds himself transformed into an angel. Yes, and no matter what the archangel said, he'd only swung once. Well, twice. Okay, three times on the golden gates. But that was just for something to do. That was the whole trouble. There wasn't anything for a small angel to do. And he was very homesick. Oh, not that paradise wasn't beautiful, but the earth was beautiful, too. Wasn't it created by God himself? Why, there were trees to climb and brooks to fish and caves to play at, Pirate Chief, the swimming hole and the sun and the rain and dark and dawn and the thick brown dust so soft and warm beneath your feet. The understanding angel smiled, and in her eyes was a long-forgotten memory of another small child long ago. Then she asked the littlest angel what would make him most happy in paradise. The cherub thought for a moment and whispered in her ear, "There's a box. I left it under my bed back home. If only I could have that." The understanding angel nodded her head. "You shall have it." And a fleet-winged heavenly messenger was instantly dispatched to bring the box to paradise. And then, in all those timeless days that followed, everyone wondered at the great change in the littlest angel, for among all the cherubs in God's kingdom, he was the most happy. His conduct was above the slightest reproach. His appearance was all that the most fastidious could wish for. And on excursions to Elysian fields, it could be said, and truly said, that he flew like an angel. Then it came to pass that Jesus, the Son of God, was to be born of Mary, of Bethlehem, of Judea. And as the glorious tidings spread through paradise, all the angels rejoiced and their voices were lifted to herald the miracle of miracles, the coming of the Christ child. The angels and the archangels, the seraphim and cherubim, the gatekeeper, the wingmaker, yes, and even the halo smith, put aside their usual tasks to prepare their gifts for the blessed infant, all but the littlest angel. He sat himself down on the topmost step of the golden stairs and anxiously waited for inspiration. What could he give that would be most acceptable to the Son of God? At one time, he dreamed of composing a lyric hymn of adoration, but the littlest angel was woefully wanting in musical talent. Then he grew tremendously excited over writing a prayer that would live forever in the hearts of men, because it would be the first prayer ever to be heard by the Christ child. But the littlest angel was lamentably lacking in literate skill. What, oh, what could a small angel give that would please the holy infant? The time of the miracle was very close at hand when the littlest angel at last decided on his gift. Then, on that day of days, he proudly brought it from his hiding place behind a cloud and humbly, with downcast eyes, placed it before the throne of God. It was only a small, rough, unsightly box, but inside were all those wonderful things that even a child of God would treasure. A small, rough, unsightly box lying among all those other glorious gifts from all the angels of paradise, gifts of such rare and radiant splendor and breathless beauty that heaven and all the universe were lighted by the mere reflection of their glory. And when the littlest angel saw this, he suddenly knew his gift to God's child was irreverent, and he devoutly wished he might reclaim his shabby gift. It was ugly. It was worthless. If only he could hide it away from the sight of God before it was even noticed. But it was too late. The hand of God moved slowly over all that bright array of shining gifts, then paused, then dropped, then came to rest on the lowly gift of the littlest angel. The littlest angel trembled as the box was opened, and there, before the eyes of God and all his heavenly host, was what he offered to the Christ child. And what was his gift to the blessed infant? Well, there was a butterfly with golden wings, captured one bright summer day on the high hills above Jerusalem, and a sky blue egg from a bird's nest in the olive tree that stood to shade his mother's kitchen door. Yes, and two white stones found on a muddy riverbank where he and his friends had played like small brown beavers, and at the bottom of the box, a limp, tooth-marked leather strap, once worn as a collar by his mongrel dog, who had died as he had lived in absolute love and infinite devotion. The littlest angel wept hot, bitter tears, for now he knew that instead of honoring the Son of God, he had been most blasphemous. Why had he ever thought the box was so wonderful? Why had he dreamed that such utterly useless things would be loved by the blessed infant? In frantic terror, he turned to run and hide from the divine wrath of the Heavenly Father, but he stumbled and fell, and with a horrified wail and clatter of halo, rolled in a ball of consummate misery to the very foot of the heavenly throne. There was an ominous and dreadful silence in the celestial city, a silence complete, undisturbed, save for the heartbroken sobbing of the littlest angel. Then suddenly, the voice of God, like divine music, rose and swelled through paradise, and the voice of God spoke, saying,
"Of all the gifts of all the angels, I find that this small box pleases me most. Its contents are of the earth and of men, and my son is born to be the king of both. These are the things my son too will know and love and cherish, and then, regretful, will leave behind him when his task is done. I accept this gift in the name of the child, Jesus, born of Mary, this night in Bethlehem."
There was a breathless pause, and then the rough, unsightly box of the littlest angel began to glow with a bright, unearthly light. Then the light became a lustrous flame, and the flame became a radiant brilliance that blinded the eyes of all the angels. None but the littlest angel saw it rise from its place before the throne of God, and he, and only he, watched it arch the firmament to stand and shed its clear, white, beckoning light over a stable where a child was born. There it shone on that night of miracles, and its light was reflected down the centuries deep in the heart of all mankind. Yet earthly eyes, blinded too by its splendor, could never know that the lowly gift of the littlest angel was what all men would call forever the shining star of Bethlehem.
This is Flo Hale, and it's Arts Alive, etc. Now we have again the wonderful Allison Davey reading The Odd Potato, the story of a young brother and sister at Hanukkah time.
Rachel looked everywhere for the Hanukkah menorah, above the stove, behind books, and even under the bed. When she asked her dad to help her find it, he just shrugged and mumbled something about the attic and just sat in his chair. He had not been any help last year either. Since his wife's death a long 18 months ago, Mr. Levy had shown no interest in holidays. Their sparkle had been snuffed out by his sorrow. He still prayed at the synagogue, but celebrations were another story. Last Hanukkah, Rachel and her brother Sammy had spent the week with their cousins in Minneapolis. But this year, the Levy children would be at home. Still, Rachel was not discouraged. She had saved enough money from her weekly allowance to buy gifts for her father and her brother, along with dreidels and candles from the synagogue gift shop. Now her only problem was to locate the family menorah. Except for a dollar or two, her money was spent. A new menorah was out of the question, and she didn't dare bother her father again about the old one. Rachel remembered how much her mother had loved that menorah. It was one of the few possessions Rachel's grandmother had brought with her to America. But if her father did not want to use it, he must have a good reason. Rachel decided she would concentrate on making latkes, you know, potato pancakes, instead. She watched carefully in Hebrew school when Mrs. Rosenblum showed the class how to make the batter. She remembered watching her mother follow the very same steps each Hanukkah. Those times had always been very special. Cooking was fun. But even better was listening to her mother tell wonderful stories about her own childhood. Without fail, Sammy would ruin it by barging into the kitchen and demanding his turn to stir. The lovely calm would turn to chaos. It seemed that all Sammy had to do was look at the bowl, and batter splattered from ceiling to floor. But Rachel's mother's latkes were always scrumptious. She was not certain her own potato pancakes could match up, but she was determined to try. The afternoon before the first night of Hanukkah, Rachel stopped by Weintraub's grocery for a bag of potatoes. But she couldn't find a single one. The bin was empty. Rachel began to cry. "Rachel," exclaimed Mr. Weintraub, "don't be silly. Who cries over potatoes? I'll have more tomorrow. Buy rice instead." "You can't make latkes from rice, Mr. Weintraub," Rachel sobbed. "Well, you have a point," he agreed. "Wait here. I'll see what I can do." He disappeared into his back room. Mr. Weintraub returned a minute later holding a very odd-looking potato. "Well, it isn't much," he admitted. "All of my shoppers kept throwing it back into the bin. It's not rotten. It just looks funny. I suppose one potato won't make a lot of latkes, but it's the best I can do. Take it with my compliments." Rachel studied the curious potato for a moment and suddenly screamed with delight. "Oh, Mr. Weintraub, thank you, thank you. This is perfect. It's just right. Oh, thank you a million times." As Rachel rushed out of the store, Mr. Weintraub just shook his head and smiled. Sammy greeted his older sister as she walked through the door. "Where have you been? What's in the bag?" "I was at the grocer's to buy potatoes," she answered. Sammy grinned and squealed. "Oh, great! We'll make latkes, just like old times." He grabbed the bag from his sister's hand, and the odd potato fell to the floor. Sammy made a face. "Oh, gross!" he exclaimed. "Cancel the latkes." Rachel smiled. "Don't worry, kid. You're not eating latkes tonight. I'm saving this potato for something more important." Sammy looked puzzled. "Oh, yeah, what?" "Come into the kitchen and you'll see." Sammy followed Rachel to the sink and watched her carefully scrub and dry the mysterious potato. "So now what?" he asked. Rachel could no longer contain her excitement. "Don't you see, Sammy? It's perfect. For some reason, Daddy doesn't want to use our beautiful menorah, and I don't have any money to buy a new one." Until this afternoon, I had completely given up on lighting candles. But when I saw this potato, I remembered a story Mommy used to tell me. She always said we were lucky to have such a beautiful Hanukkah menorah. When her daddy was a little boy, his family was so poor they couldn't afford a real one, so they used a potato to hold the candles. Suddenly, Sammy understood. Oh, neat! It's perfect! That evening, before the family sat down to dinner, Rachel quietly reminded her father that it was the first night of Hanukkah. Mr. Levy smiled and said, "Yes, honey, I haven't forgotten. In fact, this afternoon I spoke to your Uncle Lewis, and your Hanukkah treat is all arranged. You and Sammy are flying to Minneapolis this weekend for a wonderful celebration." "That's great," Sammy piped up, "but we don't have to wait. Come into the kitchen. We've got a surprise for you." Mr. Levy did not know what to expect, but when he saw the odd potato holding candles for the first night of Hanukkah, tears filled his eyes. His voice trembled as he spoke. "Children, it's beautiful. Your mother would be very proud. Let us light the candles." Together they chanted the blessings as Rachel lit the candles. After dinner, they played with the dreidels Rachel had bought and congratulated her on the presents she had chosen. At bedtime, Rachel confessed to her father that she, too, would like a special Hanukkah gift. Mr. Levy smiled.
"Well, that seems only fair," he said. "Anything in particular?"
"Yes, Daddy. Please help me find our Hanukkah menorah. The potato is nice, but it's not the same."
"You're right, Rachel," he said. "Tonight I realized how much I, too, miss Mommy's beautiful menorah. We'll look for it together in the morning."
The next night, the family chanted the blessings for the second night of Hanukkah. Standing side by side were two very beautiful menorahs.
You know, Allison, thank you again for that wonderful reading. But I want to ask you a question. Did you ever have potato pancakes?
Oh, yes. I love potato pancakes.
Yeah, me too. And my first 9 years of my life were in the Bronx. So needless I say, you know, that the potato pancakes came mm-hmm. and a knish from the Jewish deli around the corner, you know. Oh. So anyway, I just hope that you enjoyed both readings, and thank you very much. And please continue to support WGXC. Thank you. So long for now.
When the bells all ring and the horns all blow, and the couples we know are fondly kissing, will I be with you? Will I be among the missing? Maybe it's just too early in the game. Oh, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing, New Year's?
New Year's.
suppose I'd ever be the one you chose. Out of a thousand invitations you receive, ah, oh, but in case I stand, here comes the jack, I'm questioning advance. What are you doing in New Year's? New Year's Eve. What are you doing New Year's Eve?
This is a song that there's a lot of Christmas songs out there, and not too many Hanukkah songs. So wrote a song for all those nice little Jewish kids who don't get to hear any Hanukkah songs. Here we go.
Put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we have eight crazy nights. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish. Just like you and me. David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli. Paul Newman's half Jewish, Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together, what a fine looking Jew. You don't need Deck the Halls or Jingle Bell Rock, 'cause you can spin a dreidel with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, both Jewish. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. The owner of the Seattle Supersonicas celebrates Hanukkah. O.J. Simpson, not a Jew. But guess who is? Hall of Famer Rod Carew. He converted.
We got Ann Landers and her sister, dear Abby.
Harrison Ford's a quarter Jewish, not too shabby.
Some people think that Ebenezer Scrooge is.
Well, he's not, but guess who is?
All three Stooges. So many Jews are in showbiz. Tom Cruise isn't, but I heard his agent is. Tell your friend Veronica, it's time you celebrate Hanukkah.
I hope I get a harmonica on this lovely, lovely Hanukkah. So drink your gin and tonica and smoke your marijuana. If you really, really want to, have a happy, 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 happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah.